In early 1849, Millicent saw that any continued co-occupancy of the Cobb plantations was impossible. Set, that Tessa May is a wily witch. Three times now she suggested in various clever ways that we might be moving to Georgia. And mealy-mouthed Percival, so tall and proper, he throws barbs at you. I'm fed up. I want to hear from your father himself what your financial prospects are, and I want to hear it now. So, much against her husband's wishes, she marched down to the jetty alone, climbed into the longboat, and had the six slaves take her to the battery, where she clanged her pretty way through the gates and confronted Maximus as he sat on the porch. Somerset and I need to know what money arrangements we can expect, Father. The old man harumphed. He had never discussed such matters with women, not even with his wife, one of the Radburn girls. Now he equivocated. Well, with Edisto, our income from all that land, he has no cause to worry. But if we wanted to purchase a plantation of our own, Millicent said boldly, that would be foolish in the extreme, wouldn't it? We don't think so, she said bluntly. Well, I do, and he would discuss the matter no further. He did invite her to stay for lunch, and though she was strongly disposed to reject the courtesy, because he was a lonely old man hungry for companionship, she did stay. But that was a mistake, for when the slaves were gone from the room, she said bluntly, Father, you really must explain to Set and me what our position is going to be. When I die... I didn't say that. But you meant it. I did not mean it. I meant that my husband is a grown man of 32, and you're treating him like a boy of 13. Why do you need to know about money? Haven't you always been cared for? In a moment of anger, she snapped, Because we might want to move to Georgia. As soon as the words were out, she regretted them. For at the reiteration of a name which had given him much grief, he seemed to wilt, as if his long-absent brother, now dead, had thrown at him once more the word Georgia. You would go to Georgia? He uttered the word as if it represented some leprous sight denied the graciousness of Carolina, and Millicent was prepared to retract. But before she could do so, Trajan came in to clear the table. And it was in that moment, seeing this impeccable black man, that she thought, When we go, we must take Trajan with us. Upon her return to the house on Edisto, which they now shared with the Percifer Cobbs, she very quietly told Set, Your father practically dismissed me, would tell me nothing. On Edisto, we're millionaires. On the streets of Charleston, we're paupers. Now I want you to find out in exact dollars how much we have. When Somerset, as an obedient son, learned that his wife had actually revealed their conversations about going to Georgia, he was aghast, for he appreciated how deeply this must have hurt his father. Still, he had long realized that sooner or later the possibility of such a move must surface. And when Millicent's unemotional review of the situation ended, he concluded that perhaps she had accomplished something desirable in clearing the air. Next day, they posted a letter to Cousin Reuben in Georgia, asking him to come down and give advice. In such speculation, whether family or public, Set remained so passive that some considered him slow, especially when his wife's opinions were so pertinent. But it was genteel reserve rather than lack of comprehension which prevented him from airing his opinions. So he allowed her to pose the options, Georgia or Mississippi, with her favoring the longer jump west and he the shorter. However, each was willing to adjust to the other's preference. On a fine summery day in June, when the cotton was well established and hoed, Reuben Cobb and his wife Petty Prue, each 26 years old and brimming with vigor induced by the Georgia uplands, roared into Charleston and pretty well blew the place apart. Reuben was 6 feet tall, slim and fine-looking like all the Cobb men, but with fiery red hair, which none of the others had. He wore long mustaches, also red, which he liked to twirl when disputing a point in a powerful voice which rode down opposition. At the first big dinner in his honor, given grudgingly by his Uncle Maximus, he was out on the porch arguing cotton when his loud exclamations penetrated the room inside as he boasted, to the disgust of certain gentlemen who specialized in Sea Island. Short staple is king. Those Manchester mills can't get enough of it. And whether you're ready to believe it or not, the man who rules short staple is gone to rule this country. The eye of the Georgia Hurricane was Petty Prue, the tiny, winsome daughter of a Methodist clergyman who had never planted a row of cotton in his life, but who had taught his little girl all she needed to know. To get along in this life, you got to please people. She was 5'1", weighed not over 100 pounds, and had cultivated such an excessive southern drawl that she could pronounce even the briefest word in 3 syllables. With her, more became more, delivered in a high, lilting voice. She looked directly at anyone who spoke to her, smiling ravishingly at women and men alike, as if each in turn were the prettiest or wittiest in the room. She was a giddy little bird, all gold and silver, who engulfed the normal reticence of southern decorum in an irresistible enthusiasm which bubbled unceasingly from her pouting lips. 2 women, watching the visiting Cobbs from a corner, observed, "You can tell they're not from Charleston." But they were clearly eligible to belong, had they wished, for they were charming, volatile, and, according to Georgia standards, well-bred. And at every critical moment they assured listeners of their undeviating loyalty to the South. "Our men could sweep the field if it ever came to a test of arms," Reuben boomed from his position near the punch bowl. "Ask Persifer. In the Mexican War, hardly a single northern officer measured up to the best of ours. Don't lecture me about railroad mileage and factories that belch smoke. It's character that counts." By the time that first noisy evening ended, the ladies and gentlemen of Charleston were satisfied that the Cobbs of Georgia were not only acceptable, but also downright enjoyable. "Shame he ever left us. We need men like him." And as for Petty Prue, clearly not gentlefolk and rather loud, but she has a quality that melts the heart. Let's have them over. However, it was on the plantation that the Georgia Cobb revealed his true merit. For Reuben had the rare ability of looking at evidence and quickly reaching sound conclusions, a skill that few men commanded. "Your soil's failing, Persifer. Perniger, there's no way you can do well on this plantation." And when Persifer said that he could always import fertilizer, Reuben said loudly, "Waste half your profits. At your age, with your skills, you ought to get out of here." "And go where?" Persifer asked with obvious disdain. "Georgia?" "No, it's doomed too. Yield Perniger way down." "Where then?" "Texas." At the sound of this unfortunate word, Persifer Cobb winced. That any man in his right mind might wish to leave the cultivated paradise of Edisto Island and emigrate to the savage wilderness of Texas was so improbable that it did not even deserve comment. But Set Cobb, to whom such a proposal had never before been suggested, was intrigued. Now Reuben took from his pocket a clipping from a Louisiana newspaper, and when Persifer read it, echoes of an earlier discussion began to vibrate. "I saw these figures at an office in New Orleans, and there they were. South Carolina, 250 pounds of cotton per acre. Texas, 750. "And you believe these figures?" Persifer asked. And with almost trembling excitement, Reuben replied, "I've written to the experts. They assure me that for the first years, virgin soil and all that, these results have been proved time and again." "But for how long?" Persifer asked. And Reuben replied, "Long enough to make a fortune. By then, you'd be ready to move on to fresh land." "Damn, this could be the most exciting adventure in America. Perse, Set, let's all go west." The idea that a Cobb would exchange Edisto for Texas was so repugnant to Persifer that he dismissed it haughtily. But when Reuben and little Petty Prue were alone with the Somerset Cobbs, the discussion continued. "Set, Lissa, we must all go to Texas, really. We're used up in Georgia. You're obviously used up in Edisto. We can buy land, the best bottom land, for $2 an acre. Take our wagons, our niggers, money enough to start a new paradise." He stopped abruptly and asked, "Set, how much hard cash could you scrape together?" "Now, that's difficult to say. I have a few thousand saved, but..." "Don't tell me a few thousand. How much?" "I have 8,000, and I suppose Father would want to give me something." "Don't count on that. His father gave my father nothing. But you could take your slaves with you." "Lissa and I have about 6 each, personal. We could surely take them." "Hell! Excuse me, ma'am, but I'm talking about 50, 60. Surely you could talk your family into at least 50. Obviously, he had for some months been reviewing the possibility, for he took from his pocket a carefully tabulated list of things he and Petty Prue could provide for such an expedition, and the Cobbs were amazed at its completeness. "I'll provide the cotton gin, because it has to be the best. I'll provide the cotton seed, the best Mexican strain, tested on land like we'll find in Texas. I'll take the blacksmith shop." "How many wagons are you thinking about?" Somerset asked. From another pocket, Reuben produced a list of wagons, each specified as to size, the numbers of mules or oxen required to draw it, and its order of contents. 37 were numbered, at which Millicent asked, "But why the frenzy? You don't have to move. We do." And then little Petty Prue, in her high-pitched voice and delightful accent, revealed her real reasons. "Georgia's changed. Old men make a new rules. What we seek is a new life where we can invest our money and our energy and build our own paradise." Millicent was startled to hear this giddy child speaking so boldly. "You'd be willing to take such great risks?" "I want to take them. I'm bored with Georgia." When she pronounced the word bowigged, it sounded amusing. But when Millicent saw the hard set of her chin, it wasn't funny at all. Now Petty Prue hammered at Lissa. "After all, you sent the letter. We didn't. And you sent it because you knew you were finished here. It was one of your best ideas." But when the three Cobb families dined together on the second night, some of the things that motivated red-headed Reuben began to surface. "Another reason I'd like to be in Texas, I'd like to keep my eye on the northern part of the Indian Territory that they're calling Kansas." The word had never been mentioned before in Edisto, and it sounded strange the way Reuben said it, as if it carried terrible freight. "Great decisions are going to be made in Kansas, and I want..." "What decisions?" Millicent asked. "Slavery. If those swine in the north can prevent us from carrying our slaves into open territory like Kansas, they can halt our entire progress." "Will Texas remain slave?" Somerset asked, and his cousin cried, "Without question. They fought Santa Anna because he wanted to end slavery. They know how to protect their rights." "I would not care to bet on anything where Texas is involved," Percifer said. But Reuben stopped this reasoning bluntly. "Where are Texans from?" "Tennessee, a slave state. Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, all slave. Texas will be there when we need her." "Will we need her?" Percifer asked. And a hush fell over the candlelit room. The long silence that followed was broken only by the chirping of crickets in the warm night air, until finally Reuben stated his beliefs. "I've met a few abolitionists, sneaked into Georgia. Fine-looking men, but absolutely corrupt at heart, coming here to steal our property. They'll never surrender. But men like us three won't ever surrender either. There must come a testing." "I should think you'd want to be here," Percifer said, for he had heard that his Georgia cousin was a violent man. "In Georgia, each good man will count for one. In Texas, he'll count for two. Why do you say that? Because many of the big decisions will be reached there. Control of the West, control of Kansas, and a role in helping to control the Mississippi. I want to be where I'll count double. The man now went on to the porch, where Somerset tried quietly to explain that he believed the real disparity between South and North was not slavery, but the callous way in which the North profited from Southern raw materials and then imposed through Congress excessive tariffs which prevented the South from obtaining the goods it needed from Europe. Millicent, listening to an argument she had heard before, indicated to Pettiprew that she wanted to pursue further their abbreviated table discussion. So when Tessa May took herself to bed, the two younger women sat in the light of a flickering candle and discussed the tremendous matter of moving a civilization west for more than 1,000 miles. "Does it frighten you?" Millicent asked. And Pettiprew said brightly, "Not a bit. Thousands are going to California all the time. If they can do it, we can easily reach Texas." She sought for a word and said, "It'll really be like a great picnic that lasts for 100 days." 100 days? Yes, Reuben has it all worked out, from Edisto. He seems sure we're going. And so am I." With never a faltering doubt, the little Georgia woman, in her mid-20s and already the mother of three, said, "The time comes, that's all I can say. It's like when a young man of 20 and a young girl of 18, the time comes and everything that seemed so tangled falls into place. It's time for you and Set to get out, and that's that." In the days that followed, when it became generally accepted that the Somerset Cobbs were going to withdraw gracefully from any competition for the Edisto plantation, both Persifer and Tessa May became wondrously generous. No decision had yet been voiced by their father as to how much money Set could take with him. But word on that would come in due course. "For the present," Persifer said, "you can take 20 of our Edisto field hands, no question. Trajan belongs on Edisto, really, but I'd want him." "Trajan, you shall have. I'll explain to Father." Millicent nominated 9 of the best female house slaves, women who could sew dresses and shirts, and they were surrendered too, with Tessa May adding 2 others that she knew Lissa favored, making 32 in all. Persifer, looking far ahead, said, "Western Alabama and Mississippi, those roads were never solid. You'll need the best wagons." And he started his wheelwrights and carpenters to mending 9 wagons already in existence and building 7 new ones. But when the first provisional lists of gear were compiled, it was obvious that Set would be wise to buy another 3 in Charleston. Maximus Cobb made petulant protest over the loss of Trajan, whom he had been breaking in nicely as a house servant. But on this point his sons were adamant, with Persifer leading the fight. "A Carolina gentleman is entitled to at least 1 perfect servant. It lends him distinction. And for Set, Trajan is ideal." When his father continued to demur, Persifer said, "They were like brothers." And to this the old man had to assent. When the time came that discussion of money could no longer be deferred, Maximus said, "I'll tell you one thing. If you were going to Georgia, like my brother Septimus, you'd get not a nickel. Not a nickel. But if you're going to Texas to help preserve our southern way of life, to spread goodness and justice..." He fumbled with his ivory-headed cane, and tears came to his eyes. "Why do young people feel they have to leave? What have we ever done to wrong you, Somerset? Tell me, what?" "The time comes," Somerset said. And his father seemed to accept this, for he took from his pocket a letter, a copy of one, the original having already been mailed to a New Orleans bank. And before delivering it to his younger son, he said, with evident sadness, "It's my gift to you and Lissa in your new life." It was a draft for $20,000. On Sunday, the last day of September, 1849, the Cobb brothers, their wives, and their five children gathered at the mansion in Charleston, where an Episcopalian minister had been invited to say prayers, after which a fine feast was managed by Suetonius and three of his Caesars, Tiberius, Claudius, and Domitian. Trajan was overseeing the four wagons that would leave from Charleston in the morning to meet up with the 15 others that would be crossing the Edisto ferry and coming up to the main road. It was a beautiful day, and in the late afternoon the two couples with their children walked along the Battery, looking out to Fort Sumter in the bay. At night, singers came from a mansion nearby, and various families who had once thought of allying their children with Somersets dropped by to say confused farewells, for they were losing prime candidates for future marriage alliances. At dawn, everyone was alert. The four wagons, with their borrowed horses, were ready for the taxing ride to where the heavier wagons coming directly from Edisto would be waiting. Kisses, tears, embraces, and prayers were exchanged. And finally, old Maximus waved one of his canes, and the Somerset Cobbs bade farewell to one of the most gracious houses in Carolina and to the best of the offshore islands. GTT, gone to Texas, could have been painted on their four wagons, for like thousands who preceded them, they had watched their fortunes at home slowly decline. But it was at dusk on that first day when the true farewells were said, because as the little caravan approached the spot where the ferry road from Edisto joined the main road, the Cobb children, riding in the lead wagon, shouted back to their parents, "Oh, look!" And there ahead, waiting as shadows deepened, stood the other 15 wagons. Around them clustered not only the slaves who would go with them to Texas, but also some 100 others who had trudged up from the island to say goodbye. There was not much sleeping that night, for groups clustered here and there, exchanging little gifts, whispering in Gullah, and savoring the precious moments of friendships that would be shared no more. For as long as anyone could remember, no Cobb of Edisto had ever separated a slave child from its parents, and none were being separated now. For example, Trajan and his wife were taking their boy Hadrian with them. But inevitably, adult brothers and sisters were seeing each other for the last time, and many others were being separated from their old parents. There was sorrow, but as the night waned, there was also singing, soft hymns chanted in Gullah. "Oh, I shall never see you again," a young woman cried to a man she might have married had he stayed on Edisto. And at dawn, the caravan of 19 wagons moved on to Texas, 4 white people and 32 slaves, plus 3 babes still in arms. On this second day of October, 1849, the plodding trek westward began, with Trajan's wagon in the lead as the mules and oxen shuffled along at their own measured pace. By noontime, the drivers had learned how much distance to leave between wagons so that dust did not engulf them. By late afternoon, when the first stop occurred, the line of wagons covered about a mile and a half, and there was much joking among the slaves as the last one pulled in. As soon as the wagons carrying the Cobbs and their private gear halted, male and female slaves sprang into action, pitching the master's tents, arranging for baths, and starting the evening meal. On this first night it was a noisy game, with cooks unable to find pots and maids not knowing where the bedding was. But with stern prompting from Trajan, things were straightened out, and the expedition assumed some kind of rational order. It was 134 miles from Edisto to the South Carolina line opposite the city of Augusta, and Somerset had calculated that the distance could be covered in not more than 12 days. But on Saturday, when they were about halfway across the narrow part of the state, Millicent announced with some finality that she did not intend traveling on Sunday. When he started to protest, he found that all the slaves supported his wife most vociferously. "We ain't never work Sundays. Ain't proper." With Mrs. Cobb, it was a matter of religion, but with the slaves it was religion come custom, with the latter weighing the heavier. "Work 6 days. God says so. Even he works 6 days. But come seven, no more, neither God nor man. Trajan was a leader in this rebellion. So, at sunset that first Saturday, Set Cobb ordered the tents pitched securely, for nothing he could say or do was going to change the fact that they would stay beside this rivulet for 2 nights. On the second Saturday night, the enforced halt irritated him even more, because the caravan had now reached the Carolina shore of the Savannah River, across which the buildings of Augusta could be clearly seen. "We could get up tomorrow at dawn and be in the city in time for morning prayers," he argued. But Lissa would not listen. "The Sabbath is God's holy day, and if we profane it at the start of our trip, what evils will he pour down upon us in the later days?" Set said that he doubted God was paying much attention to one small group of wagons on the Augusta Road, but Millicent prevailed. They entered Augusta very early on Monday, October 15th, and spent the next 2 days making purchases of things they had discovered they needed. Set figured that this shopping would please his wife, but when he returned to the wagons at dusk on Tuesday, he found her looking across the river and weeping. "I shall never see Carolina again. Look at it, Set. It's the gentlest and loveliest state in the Union." He remained with her for a long time, staring back at that lovely state in which he had been so happy and of which he was so proud. The next week was hard work, a slow, slogging progress along the bumpy roads of northern Georgia. And for 3 solid days, enduring a considerable amount of rain, they pushed their way west through the little towns of Greensboro and Madison, and by Thursday morning, when the sky cleared, Set was in fine spirits. At breakfast he said, "Everybody watch closely today and tomorrow. May be a big surprise." So the 2 children rode forward with Trajan, peering ahead like Indian scouts. And about noon they were rewarded by seeing a lone rider, a very large black man, coming toward them on a mule. As he drew closer, he began to shout, "You de Cobb's Famedisto?" And when Trajan waved his whip enthusiastically, the big man reined in his mule, lifted his arms in the air, and began shouting, "Halleloo, I done found you." He was Jexifer, prime hand of the Georgia Cobbs, dispatched along this road to meet the caravan. He had acquired his name in a curious way. Reuben Cobb, seeking to retain a sentimental tie with his cousins on Edisto, had named him Persifer in honor of the family's soldier hero. But in Gullah, the word had been quickly corrupted to Jexifer. "My job, show you de way home," he explained. And after the wagons fell in behind him, he pranced his mule and shouted, "Halleloo, we on our way to Texas." He rode with them all day on the 26th, shouting to everyone they passed, "Halleloo, we for Texas." And that night he told the children, who had by now adopted him, for he was just as vigorous and loud as his master, "Tomorrow we home, finest town in Georgia." "What's its name?" the children asked. And he replied, "Social Circle." And they said, "That's no name for a town." And he corrected them, "It be the name of this town, and this town is Queen of Georgia." Early on Saturday, he led them along the last dusty roads to Social Circle, an attractive village which boasted 2 cotton gins, warehouses for the storing of finished bales, and a beautiful old well right in the middle of the main street. Waiting there, as men and women had waited for many decades to greet their friends, were Reuben and Petty Prue, who provided ladles of cool water for the travelers. "Our town had another name once," Petty Prue explained, "but since everyone gathered about this pump for local gossip, it became Social Circle." After so many days of dusty travel, 27 of them, the Edisto Cobbs were delighted with the 5 days they stayed over in Social Circle. The main street was lined with 9 large houses, each with handsome white pillars supporting fine balconies that opened out from the upper floors, each with flower beds and finely graveled turnarounds for the carriages. "Somebody's making money here," Set cried, when at the end of this first parade of tall mansions he saw another six of somewhat smaller size. "Everybody is, for the moment," Reuben said. "These men know how to grow cotton, how to work their slaves." Set was especially interested in the cotton gins, for as a grower of Sea Island, he had never worked short staple, and for some years had believed that no one else could either. So Reuben took him to a gin owned collectively by all the Cobbs of the region, a sturdy wooden building of two stories, with the bottom one mostly open, so that slave boys could lead two pairs of horses around and around in a perpetual circle. The horses were harnessed to long wooden arms projecting outward from a central pillar, which revolved slowly but with great force. The pillar reached well up through the second floor, where its constant turning provided motive power for an Eli Whitney gin of 50 saws. The bowls of filmy white cotton passing these saws had their tenacious green seeds removed, the latter falling down a chute to the ground after wire brushes caught their filaments. "Not much different from what we do by hand with Sea Island and Carolina," Somerset muttered while studying the wonderful effectiveness of the gin. As it continued its work, handling the fractious seed so competently, he had a vision of that endless chain of which he had always been a part. The land tilled, the seed sown by slaves, the tender plants chopped to eliminate weeds and weaklings, the bowls gathered, the seeds removed, the bales sent to the rivers, the ships loaded, the cotton delivered to Liverpool, the spun thread delivered to Manchester, the cloth woven, the clothing made, civilization enhanced, and every man in the chain earning a good living from this miraculous fiber. Cotton was surely a king among crops. The slave, Cobb reflected, lived well under the loving care of kind masters. The planter watched his lands flourish. The owner of the gin extracted his fee, the shipper his, and the Liverpool merchant his pounds and shillings. The weaver seemed to earn most, with the manufacturer of clothes not far behind. "Wait," he called to the busy gin, as if to correct some misapprehension under which it toiled. "The one who makes the most is the damned banker who finances it all." In his many years of supervising the vast fields on Edisto Island, Cobb, unlike Tessa May's family, had never once planted with his own or his family's money. Now, he thought, it was tradition to use the bank's money. Always they got their share first. He supposed that in Texas it would be the same. Reuben nudged him. "Wonderful machine, eh? How simple. How difficult it was to work cotton before it came along." Rather ruefully, he added, "You know, Set, we Southerners dreamed about a gin like this for 100 years, even worked on crude designs now and then. A damned schoolteacher from Massachusetts comes down here on vacation or something, studies the problem 1 week, and produces this." With profound admiration, he watched the gin as it ceaselessly picked the fiber from the seed. As long as the boys below kept the horses walking and the central pole turning on its axis, so long would the miraculous gin do in an hour what 1,000 nimble fingers in Virginia once took a month to complete. "This gin ensures the South's domination," Reuben said, almost gloatingly. "The world needs clothing, and it can't afford wool." Grabbing a handful of lint, he apostrophized it. "Get along to Galveston, and then to the mills in Lancashire, then as a bolt of cloth on some freighter headed for Australia. The world has to have what you provide, and if the North ever tried to interrupt our cotton trade, all the armies and navies of Europe would spring to our defense." Patting the gin, he said, "You are our shield in battle." Then he laughed. "How ironical history can be, Set. Maybe the greatest invention of mankind, certainly of our South, and the genius who made it earned not a penny." "I didn't know that. Of course, gins aren't that important to Sea Island." "Whitney lost his patent. Never really got it, because the gin was so vital that everyone moved in and simply copied it. Lawyers, you know." As Reuben said these words, his cousin noted that he was looking at the gin strangely, as if trying to remember each element of its movement so that it could be duplicated in Texas. But this seemed odd, because a good commercial gin could be bought from many sources for less than $100. Powered by one of the new steam engines, it might cost $100.50, so that any important cotton plantation could afford its own. For 5 days, the citizens of Social Circle entertained the immigrants in one big mansion after another, until Millicent cried at one dinner, "You have certainly proved your right to your name. This is the socialist circle I've ever been in." And a banker responded with an apt toast. "To the Cobbs, the first group ever to leave Georgia for Texas without the sheriff chasing them." On the morning of Thursday, November 1st, the Georgia Cobbs moved their wagons into line, and as they did so, Millicent, to her amazement, counted 38. "Good heavens, Prue, are you taking everything you own?" she asked. And Prue replied, "Yes." So the caravan was formed. Edisto wagons, 19, Georgia, 38. Edisto slaves, 32, Georgia, 49. Edisto whites, 4, Georgia, 5. Plus one Bible from Edisto, and certain remarkable items from Georgia. On Friday, Set discovered how remarkable the items were, for when one of the wagons mired in the mud, he saw that it contained the metal parts of the disassembled gin which he had been studying only a few days before. He recognized the splashes of yellow color, and especially the saw mechanism, which carried in iron letters the name of the manufacturer. Reuben Cobb, on that last night when the banker was extolling his honesty, had been busy stealing one of the town's two gins. "Oh, it belongs to me, you might say," he explained. "It's a Cobb gin, that's for sure, but it belonged to the other Cobbs. They owed me a lot, and they can get another." However, Set noticed that, despite his bravado, Reuben followed a most circuitous route around Atlanta, keeping a rear lookout posted in case sheriffs tried to recover the gin. Once, when the lead wagon was well and truly mired in the mud of Mississippi, the Edisto Cobbs caught a glimpse of their cousin's darker nature, for after minutes of bellowing at Jaxifer to get the wagon moving, Reuben lost his temper and thrashed the struggling slave with a whip he kept at hand. 17, 18 times he lashed the big, silent man across the back, and it would have been difficult to guess who was the more appalled by this performance, the Edisto whites or the Edisto blacks. For during his entire stewardship of the island plantation, Set Cobb had never whipped a slave. He had disciplined them, and occasionally he threw them into the plantation jail, but never had he whipped one, nor had he allowed his overseers to do so. Although the whites and blacks may have been equally appalled, it was the latter who suffered in a unique way. You could see it in the way Trajan cringed when the strokes of the whip fell. You could hear it in the gasps of the Edisto women. For this incident in the swamps of Mississippi demonstrated what slavery really meant. When one slave was whipped, all slaves were whipped. When Trajan, quivering with outrage, sought to move forward to aid Jaxifer, Set reached out a restraining hand, and without words having been said, Trajan knew that his master was promising, "We Edisto people will never do it that way." It was an ironclad rule of the Cotton States, broken only by fools, that one white master never reproved another in the presence of slaves, and Somerset Cobb was especially attentive to this rule, so that when the thrashing ended, he felt ashamed of himself for having revealed his feelings to his slave Trajan, and he attempted to assuage his conscience by going quietly to Reuben that evening and saying, "You were having a hard time with Jaxifer. That wagon was really mired." Sometimes boys like Jaxifer require attention. "They really do, Reuben, they really do." Then he added, almost offhandedly, "At Edisto we never whipped our niggers." And he said this with such calm force that Reuben knew that, whereas he might beat his own slaves, he must never touch Set's.